Hello everybody and welcome back to another spoiler review with me, A Border Prince. Today we are talking about book 16 of the Gaunt's Ghost series, Anarch, by Dan Abnett. Now I'm going to assume that you know Gaunt's Ghost, so I'm not going to get into the backstory of the Gaunt's Ghost series. It's a big one and not something I want to go into there, but I do have a lore series on it. So if you want to go ahead and take a look at that, that's where you'll get the main info on sort of the campaign in general, rather than the Gaunt's Ghost in particular, but we do cover them. Now, this is the sequel to Warmaster, and it starts basically where the last one ended. There was a 10-year gap or thereabouts between these two Gaunt's Ghost novels and the previous set, Salvation's Reach being the last one. But now we return to Erdesh once again, straight after the Warmaster events. And we immediately get stuck into the story. And before we go on, spoilers, this entire this entire review will be spoilers. So, we start off with McCall being a fucking badass. He's alive, he's been captured. They enter, they're bringing in Imperial prisoners and asking them whether they want to join, basically the Sons of Sek, and judging whether they're weak or strong or whatever. And they want McCall to join because he's like, nah. And he immediately goes about and does some badass shit and kills them all. Now, he captures a Sadia and dons a Sons of Sek uniform and takes him hostage, basically, alive with a knife at his back. And yeah, that's where we leave McCall. But he's alive and he's behind enemy lines. He knows he can't get away. So what's he going to do? Well, we'll come back to that in a moment. So, what's going on with Gaunt and the rest of them? Well, Gaunt is settling into his role now as executor. He has established his authority, as we saw in the last book. The dissenters have been pushed away. He has forgiven Van Voits and given him some authority, sort of knowing that he is a useful general and not someone that should be just cast aside. He's given him a chance to redeem himself, despite the problems that they've had in the past. Way back in the books and in previous books. We have a number of... At the start of the book is, you know, we have the McCall section. You're like, oh, no way, McCall's alive, and he's fucking amazing still. Then we have Gaunt going through some... the politics of the situation. Not as much as last time, which I'm a bit disappointed about, but still, good. Right, then we go to the ghosts themselves. The regiment has been left out at the front line for a long time, for an extended period. Another regiment they were fighting alongside with broke and ran during the assault and what appears to be a diversionary assault as we move forward. And appears to have been a diversionary assault so that the elite Kimra, I've never actually said that out loud, I've only read it. Kimra, an elite Sons of Sek force can infiltrate the city. It appears that's the setup for it. But they've been left out. And I've got to say, a lot of the combat scenes that we have very, very closely mirror to me stuff that you would, if you sort of study the Iraq War, if you've seen documentaries about that, if you've read accounts and things, recent sort of combat situations in the real world. And I think Dan Abnett's drawn a lot of that. It's influenced a lot of what happens in this story more, the city fighting and so on, and other stuff as we go forward. The insurgency they're fighting with troops that are left behind to fight within the city of Elteth. Is it Elteth? I think it is. that's what's going on with the Gaunt. They're hung out. They've been at the front for a very extended long time, and that's where they are right now, under Rorn's command, of course. And we rejoin McCall. Now McCall has decided to join to merge in with the Sons of Sek as they're moving to a sort of staging ground for themselves, for their assault in this area, in this region. And it turns out to be a giant island, which is a burnt-out volcano. And I've got to say, this is one of the coolest... It really sets the scene. So there's Imperial prisoners there, massive amounts of men and material for the Sons of Sek forces. And in the middle of this... You know, if you see these tropical islands in the Mediterranean, sometimes they're like... and, you know, other places... dead volcanoes where you just have the top of it, you know, the ring or an opening into the ring, and people live there. They build houses in the ring, in the side of the ring, on the inner ring, and it's like a perfect place to have, really, because it's sheltered from the elements. you know, storms and so on, but you've got easy access. And obviously being a volcano, it's a pretty deep place for ships. And this is what's going on, really. All these ships are heading towards this place with troops. It's a staging point. But floating in the middle of this is a relatively small, but still pretty big for like surface operations, cruiser, spaceship, floating above the surface and, you know, getting reinforcements into it, getting repaired and so on. And this is Sex. This is Sex's personal ship. And yeah, he's on board it. So McCall is there, and yeah, we get some interesting stuff about him noticing things about who the Sons of Sek are, and we'll get more of that as we go along. So we rejoin Gaunt, and they're having discussions about investigations into the regiment because of what happened on Salvation's Reach, because of events that have transpired since, because of their interaction with the Eagle Stones. Gol Collier comes up into the conversation a lot. There's an Inquisitor there now. If you've read the previous book, you saw the sort of the opening elements of this. They're being observed, basically, I would say, rather than under direct suspicion, because a lot of shit's happened. But again, this rubs me wrong slightly because of how the Imperium is with Chaos Guys. Now, I know they're at the Crusade front. They're away from the sort of mainstream of Imperium society. So a lot of things are let go that wouldn't necessarily be let go in the heart of the Imperium. But it still rubs me a bit wrong that this Inquisitor isn't at least being more cautious. You know, if they were more cautious, there'd be more firing squads. But yeah, it rubs me a bit wrong that there's not that much of a... They're under investigation, they're being asked questions and stuff, but there's no... I don't know. I would expect a more harsh reaction, but... Here we are, you know. That we hear more stuff about the Eagle Stones, what they are. It's sort of underplayed until later on at the end of the book how important the Eagle Stones are, but we'll get to that when we get to it. The politics sort of stuff is still going on. It's interesting. Again, there's not as much politics as there was in the previous books, which I'm disappointed about because I love nothing more than hearing. I want to just see Imperial generals discuss like the philosophy of the Imperium and shit like this and what they're doing. I think that's badass. And I want more of it. The Blenner situation is still going on with Merrin and so on. The murder that occurred and the almost death of Merity Chase. Gaunt's, you know, one night stand. the result of his one night stand on Vervenhive. And yeah, that's it really. That's that element of the book, the first chunk. Now, we rejoin McColl. He's infiltrating the base. We have... He kills that many people. It's fucking great. Throughout this story, he's got the highest body count of anyone, and it's mostly done with a knife, which is fucking amazing. Now, this is the point where things start kicking off. We have the Gaunts, the ghosts, that are split up into two teams. The main body of the regiment under Pasha, Colonel Pasha, the chick, they go off to a place called the Mechanicor, which is an Adaptus Mechanicus facility, research facility, I guess you'd say, where the Eagle Stones have been sent to be researched. And they are sent there to secure them and bring them back to headquarters for safekeeping. Now, the other element is Rorn leads the Suicide Kings in a mission to rescue the Fegoth Mabon, the traitor, Chaos Traitor guy. And he's been a long-standing element in the Gaunt's Ghosts for at least the last four or five books. And this is where we learn a bit more about him, ironically. And, yeah, that's what happens. So, at the Mechanicor, we get some amazing moments again. Oh, before I go on. So, what's happened is one of the Erdesh noble houses has rebelled. Right, as turned traitor, because Erdesh is in a particularly interesting position, being on the edge of the Sabbat Worlds, close to the Sanguinary Worlds, and in the constant toing and froing for power in this region over the centuries. Erdesh has fallen under the sway of Chaos many times, and not necessarily Chaos, but they've just aligned with them, aligning with the Imperium and aligning with the Sanguinary Worlds tribes. Isn't that different, you know? It's just a new set of masters you have to pay taxes for. And this guy He feels like he's being hammered in by the Mechanicus, by the Imperium, their demands, what they expect from them. Whereas the Chaos guys are offering them a new deal. And he's like, well, I'll take the deal and, you know, we'll get rid of the Imperium and these guys will come back on and we'll start making profits again. We'll retake glory for my house, that sort of thing. It's not necessarily Chaos corruption. So what he's done is he's going to allow a strike team of the Sons of Sek to infiltrate the Imperial lines. And his another part of the bargain is he's going to distribute a signal which will alert all of the sleeper cells and broken and left behind remnants of the Sons of Sek armies in the region. And they will all rise up as one, causing disruption. And this is what causes the ghosts to be split and, you know, some of them sent off to the Mechanicor to reclaim their stones before anything happens to them. And why the Suicide Kings go after Mabon, the traitor, to secure him. So, that's where we are. Now, who are these strike team that has been sent to do this work? The Chaos guys are known as the Kimra, I'm not too sure how to pronounce it. They're elite sect troops. Now, there's 8x8 of them, which is, you know, the magic of numbers. The memeology of it all. They have been flesh wrought. They've been remade as not wholly human. They are able to shapeshift. They are able to absorb massive amounts of damage. They are strong, they're powerful, they're capable. They have warp powers, I guess you would say. They've been invested with the powers of the warp. They are no longer human. And these guys have been dispatched to do this job, to reclaim the Eagle Stones and to kill the traitor Mabon. And that's where things stand. Now, while this is going on, all this stuff kicks off with Yonsi, I believe. Now, should we get into that? No, we'll cover this bit off first before I get into the Yonsi stuff. So, in the Mechanicor, the ghosts arrive, a chunk of the regiment stays outside to do guard duty, basically, and they're attacked by insurgents. Now, again, this very much points to me that Dan Abnett has been very influenced by a lot of the sort of recent military adventures in the East and so on that we've seen. If he's seen some of the same things as me, documentaries and certain TV dramas and stuff like this, I can see the influence coming through. For instance, we get a suicide truck packed full of explosives heading towards the ghost line. Now, instead of blowing it up, because if they blow it up, the amount of munitions that are on this truck will clearly still hurt them because it will just be such a vast explosion. So what they do is they wait for the truck to go past and one of the snipers jumps up. I think it's Banda. Yeah, she pops up and plugs a bolt, a hotshot round through the driver, through his head, knocking him out before he can press the button and kill them all. So that's a nice little element, but it's very much a feature of things I have seen before. And if anyone's, you know, studied these things or has been through these things, you can appreciate the danger involved in this. They use the door later on to blast open the doors of the Mechanicor. Once it falls into chaos, because what happens is the Kimra have used the underground vents because Erdesh is like a volcanic world. That's why it's such a suitable forge world, because it's got all of this volcanic energy that can easily be tapped, you know, for the forging of weapons and manufactories and stuff like that. And they use these ventilation shafts that are underneath to infiltrate the Mechanicus position. So you've got this chunk of these Chaos elite troopers in the base, and the Tanith arrive just after them. And as they are heading towards the Eagle Stones to reclaim them, a firefight ensues as the two forces run into each other. These guys annihilate the Mechanicus guys. And I like what he does with the Mechanicus guys. They're very much, they keep firing, you know. It's a great little scene. Fantastic. But then these Chaos guys have in their possession a virus known as Berserker. And they introduce this virus into the system and it quickly spreads throughout the entire facility and all of the individual tech priests and Skitari, causing them to go mental. They go on a shooting spree, they kill everyone, they kill each other, they kill ghosts, until they eventually burn out and just collapse in on themselves. And then the building is full of just black gunk flowing from these cyborg men, which is nice. It's quite grim. A lot of ghosts die in this. It's a close confines situation. The Kimura attempt to use the vents to escape again, but they are going to be cut off by a force of ghosts underneath there, led by Tonya Creed, and a massive firefight ensues at sort of one of the main sort of ducts, I guess you'd say, as they attempt to leave with the Eagle Stones because they're of that importance, right? So, yeah, that's what's happening there. Now, Rawn makes it to the traitor guy, Mabon, just as this another team of Kimra, I don't know if I'm saying it right, I apologise if not, and manages to rescue Mabon. They've slaughtered the sort of garrison of the prison, and they manage to escape, just about. They take a lot of damage, they lose a couple of guys. They realise that these guys are super powerful. Rawn is hit pretty heavily, and they make their escape. Now, during this whole period, back at the Urdeshi Palace, which is acting as the HQ for the Crusade, where Makaroth is, where everybody is, the ghosts have been given the cellars to live in, as you know, as a safe spot to dump them, basically. And there's a lot of problems going on there, a lot of weirdness going on there. Everybody's a bit meh. But the reason is because Yonsi has taken this opportunity. Well, at the command of Sek, she has, who is her papa. it's all really creepy, man. We realise that it's not just that she's fucking weird. It's because she's actually a fucking demon. And she suddenly erupts into a demonic woe machine, spinning blades, demonically possessed. She splits apart like a clockwork creation, and just becomes this demon, slaughters everybody, and also creates like a kind of miniature vortex that cuts off this cellar area where the regiment's retinue and a lot of the regiments are staying, and begins slaughtering everyone. Now, it's like a kind of time warp. It's like a kind of time warp down there. For them, it's been days. Some of them, she's steadily going around slaughtering everybody, men, women, and children. It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad, you know. I will say, though, I think it went on a little bit too long. But it's pretty grim, the things that are happening down there. We get a bunch of stuff with Merrin and Blenner again, which is a sort of subplot that I'm interested in, but it just seems a bit too much. You know, I would have rather that was resolved and we could concentrate on the demon thing. But he's got to resolve it. You can't just like not discuss it, because he's built it up in the previous one. So it's, I think there was a lot of different strands in this book. And as we get to the end of it, a lot of these strands are cut loose, shall we say. So when we get to the new books, we'll get some a nice, clearer sort of story. But anyway, that's what's going on down there. This demon child is turning into a giant woe machine. Loads of spinning blades. It's like the Game of Thrones chair came alive and it's spinning and slaughtering everybody. And also turning back into a child and running around all the time. It's creepy. It's creepy. Just as we're getting this demonic incursion occurring, a woe machine, I guess. A woe machine is sort of like a mix of immaterium and warp technology and normal, real technology that the forces of Chaos use. And this is a theme that Dan Abnett's used a lot in Magus. In the Magus series, the Eisenhorn series, the latest one, you get a lot of that as well with what the secretive group, the secret society is going after, what they're trying to create with these golems. You know, it's very much, he's really captured that arcane technology, warp-infused technology element, and he's really running with it. And we see it here now. It's something that he's had going on for years. But you can see the ideas matured in his brain as the books have gone on. This is the sort of completion of it. And we'll see more of it going forward, I think, definitely. But yeah, while that is happening, the Saint arrives. The reincarnation of Saint Sabbath, who we met in like book 4, when Milo went off with her. And no Milo, we're told Milo's dead, but we'll see about that in a moment. And yeah, she's there. She's had a confrontation with Sek. She wounded him, but in a trap that he'd set for her. The trap was foiled, but she wasn't able to kill him. She's been at the Crusade's front edge. She has a band of inglorious bastards, I guess you want to say, special veteran troops with her. A couple of awesome dudes, basically. And Milo was one of them. and he presents Gaunt with bagpipes, the Tanith pipes that Milo used to carry around with him. As this demonic thing kicks off, she goes there with Gaunt. We have a lot of sort of spiritual stuff going on, trying to break through into this time warp zone that the demons created. And it ends with them and Gaunt and a number of troopers going in there and fighting it out with this demon. And it ends with her using the last of her powers, basically, and almost killing herself, almost draining herself in order to stop this demonic entity. And in the end, it gets weakened so much, God Collier sort of uses emotion, because the demon has been a child for so long that it's confused about the situation, you know, that it's killing the people who loved it, who brought it up. And he uses this moment for it to turn back into Yonsei for a moment before he kills it. And that ends the situation. Now, the problem is, it turns out there was two war machines for some reason. And one, the other one is, of course, Dalin. So we have Dalin turning into this and slaughtering God Collier. And I like the way he describes it. The spinning blades kind of atomize the people as they attack them. You know, they cut off limbs and stuff like this, but if it catches you full on, it'll just tear you to smithereens. Just mist of blood. Dalin is even more confused because this coincides with the death of Sek, which will get it all. Well, the wounding and the death of Sek, so his voice disappears. He goes up into the palace, the slaughter begins just again, and Gaunt and the other people have to go after them. Unfortunately, the Saint can't help because she's been knocked unconscious because she put too much into the fight and she was already weakened from her previous engagements. So she's sort of basically recharging in a medical bed. She's recharging, waiting for the Emperor's power to get her power levels back up. And we have some amazing moments though with this demonic engine running around slaughtering people. It kills a bunch of people, destroying a transport, a Valkyrie transport. We have Van Voigt coming to the rescue of Gaunt as they're pursuing this thing with a team of stormtroopers, which was fucking... This was one of the most baller moments of it, to be honest. You got all these stormtroopers just marching forward, blasting the fuck out of an elite stormtrooper force, which I want to hear more about. Van Voigt's leading them. General Van Voigt's leading them with... you know, they've got hell guns, they've got grenade launchers. It's a mess, man. It's fucking glorious. Unfortunately, the demon just rams through them, rips them all to pieces. And it eventually ends with Dalin coming up to Merity Chase, who he had the hots for, and saying, please help me, basically. Like, I don't know what's going on. I'm confused. And Gaunt sneaks up behind him and smashes him in the back with his power sword. The sword of Hieronymo Sondar, of course. He just fucking cans him off and just rams his sword in there. And he's like, oh, thanks, you distracted him. So he was weakened. And he starts cutting up and she's obviously horrified because she must have had the hots for Dalin as well. And she, you know, it's pretty quality. It's a nice moment. And then the danger is averted, basically, the demonic danger. All right, so then we go to Rorn. Right, so before we get on to the really, really cool thing, there's the almost as cool thing with Rorn. So this Kim-Ra kill team are pursuing him and Mabon. They've lost most of the Suicide Kings. Lucky Bonin almost dies, but of course we know Bonin cannot die. And there's a motorcycle outside. Lovely. They are basically backed into a corner. Rorn sends his new girlfriend off because, of course, he's got a new girlfriend who serves with him. He sends her off to get help. And basically him and Mabon are sort of reduced at the end. Rorn, with his wounds, collapses. Basically, he's useless. And Mabon has to be forced to defend him. He's been telling him the whole time, just let him kill me. What are you doing? Why are you putting your lives on the line for me? This is crazy. And he's kind of right. They should have just left him. But on principle, obviously, he's their charge and they've got to go and rescue him. And they've been ordered to do it. But yeah, they've been ripped apart or killed. And it's just Rorn lying nearly conscious, watching as Mabon stands up and defends him because they've defended him. So he has to. So we have... where is it? They confront each other, the last surviving Kim-Ra and Mabon. "Why did you turn, Mabon?" Hadrill asked. Mabon laughed. I am tired of explaining. I don't owe you any answer. Not you or anyone. I am done with war. But you sided with them, said Hadrel. For the stones, nothing more, said Mabon. But they are everything, said Hadrel. The Anarch has told us so. Enkil Vak, a certain victory. You brought it to them. The Eagle Stone Key is an abomination, said Mabon. You know what it does. I am done with war, and it is the greatest monstrosity war has built. I cannot stop this crusade, this endless bloodshed, but I thought, perhaps, I could stop that. By giving it to them, asked Jaegar, to the Corpse Prophet's chieftains? How is that not taking sides? The Anarch knows what the key does, said Mabon. He knows where to take it and how it works. But the men of the throne, they know nothing, except that the key is valuable and must be kept from you. If they possess it, they would guard it, remove it from the Sabbat worlds, keep it from you so that it could never be used. They would learn its secrets, said Hadrel. I doubt it. A thing that old? That Vorgart? They would never puzzle it out. He looked at them both. They would not know how to use it, but they would keep it safe from so Sek could never use it. The great Magyar will have the key by dawn, said Jaegar. When his voice next speaks, it will be to tell us that the key is recovered. Kurod has been sent. Mabon sagged. Then it was all for nothing, he murmured. The rain petered down around them. It was all for victory. And this was a thing you once rejoiced in. Why did that change? It changed because I was good at it, said Mabon. As Sadia, as Demogor, as Etagor, I rose and I conquered. I burned worlds. I was a champion of the Sekhite host, inculcated to the truths of the Anarch. He looked down at the ground and watched the raindrops dance around his feet. He was pleased with my service. So pleased to turn a man from one side and make him its unflinching foe. So he rewarded me. He bestowed upon me the highest honour, as a favour of my service. A blessing, said Jaegar. A curse, said Mabon. It let me see the truth, the deranged hell of the Immaterium, and those gods which dwell within it. I saw them all. I saw myself. I saw how he had changed me. I saw what he had made me. It was enough. I turned my back on war forever. And there we go. And I think that's a beautiful passage that really says a lot about the mentality of Chaos Guys. And I want to see more of that. I want to see more of the sort of internal philosophy, the logic of it. We'll get into another bit of that in a moment. But yeah, quality. So that was the end of Mabon. Anyway, they have a big scrap. Turns out Mabon was a Kimra as well. One of these elites had been altered. And he'd just been hiding it the whole time, which is a little bit terrifying. So anyway, yeah, Rorne is rescued in the end. He ends up in a hospital bed. His latest squeeze managed to get some reinforcements to come and collect them all, which is fine, you know, good stuff. So, but he's able to relate that because he was conscious enough to hear all this. So he's related that back to Imperial Command. So that's going to have repercussions going forward. Now, the rest of the ghosts have managed to reclaim the Eagle Stones after a fierce firefight with the full strength, pretty much, of the Kimra. And it was a nice firefight. And I have to say, there's a lot of flamer action in this story, and it's pretty good. And I like the look of the Kimra. They're kind of like furless werewolves with claws and neon glowing eyes, and their blood comes out all neon and shit. It's good stuff. I like it. We also get some quality time with Larkin, popping some headshots in, which is always nice. But yeah, a lot of guys die in this. A lot of guys are murdered. And they manage to... But they manage to beat them. One of them manages to get away. He cloaks himself as a gaunt, as a ghost with a cloak and everything. But they catch him. And yeah, they manage to reclaim these stones, which are then taken to the Inquisition, who then sees them and take them off for a study. So yeah, we'll see what happens with that. Hopefully it's going to lead into something interesting. But anyway, we get back to the most interesting part of the book. And I have to say, I was reading this book and I kept like out of the corner of my eye looking for the next paragraph and seeing if it was going to be a McCall bit. Is McCall's name there? He's the best part of this book, undoubtedly. And everything he does is the highlight of this. Everything else feels like a distraction, like filler, to the main bit of McCall. I know I shouldn't be looking at it like that, but I just I was that hooked on his elements of the story. I really just want a novel of him. Please, please, Dan Abnett, can we just have him a cold book? Please, come on. Cut out all this other stuff, this distraction. Even Gaunt and the politics stuff, I'll live without it. Just give me McCall being a badass, please. So yeah, he's on the ship and he goes and manages to find Milo, because when he was going through the records and stuff, he discovered that there are other ghosts, and the Secoids are trying to track down ghosts because Sec has said that they are the key to the war. They are special and they should be captured at all costs. And he's captured one. And McCall goes looking for him, basically. He's kind of determined that he's never going to escape this island, so he's trying to do as much damage as he can. And he's going to make a strike at Sec himself, trying to behead him in one last act of awesomeness. And I love the fact that that's where his mind went. He weighs it up and he goes, oh, I could call in a strike, but they might not listen to me, might not get through, might just give away my position and die without doing anything. And so he determines that, no, I'm going to go and try and chop off Sec's head instead. So that's what he does. He manages to sneak on board the ship by executing an officer stealing his uniform. They obviously all can speak Secoid because of their time on Garion. They learned the speech of the archenemy. And they go through. And if you thought McCall was great because he managed to kill a fucking dreadnought on his own, you are in for a shock with all the things he gets up to in this novel. I do highly recommend it for that alone. McCall makes his way to the brig on this ship and he finds Milo there. We also have a nice scene where he walks past a colonel being interrogated by Chaos Dudes, and they share a look, and the colonel just, you know, nods and says, carry on your way, because he can see that he's not a Chaos guy. He can tell. He makes his way there, but also he discovers there's a couple of other Imperial prisoners. There's some random dude with glasses. I'm not too sure the significance of this guy. But Milo's there, releases him from his cell. He's like submerged in this gruel, and he frees him. But they also find Holofernes, who returns to the story, who was, of course, the Iron Snake Space Marine, who joined them on Salvation's Reach, and is a fucking general badass. You know, truly, he's captured the power of the Space Marines compared to mortal men in this novel and the previous ones. They're amazing. So he got captured as well. And he releases him. He's got all these spikes in him to sort of disable him and everything. But they get him going again. So he hasn't got his armor. He's just there with his carapace armor, you know, his black carapace. And they take out the guards. They arm themselves. They disguise themselves. Eventually, he disguises himself as one of these tech guys that they have. So he's got basically an excuse for him to put on a giant cloak. And he's walking around with this sentry gun that he's ripped off its pintle thing. And yeah, it's great. It's great. They're going to use mines to detonate the sort of oratory room where Sec is going to give this speech, and they infiltrate the crowd. It's a pretty fantastic scene, and it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant, I have to say. You have the moment where Holofernes pulls open his cloak and just lets rip into this crowd of heretic scum, blasting away at them with this Gatling gun. pumping shots into Sec himself. It's absolutely glorious. He's cut down, of course, but he's sacrificed, and it's nice that it's because he's an Iron Snake. The personal guard of Sec have these power sort of staves, power spears, kind of, and he kills one of the guys. He takes it off him. Now, he could have defended himself against the guys who were this mob of people who were coming out at him, but instead he turns around and throws it like a javelin, like the Iron Snakes do on their homeworld, hunting these beasts that live in the oceans. And he throws it and spears Sec just as he's cut down by the rest of them, which is brilliant. It's sacrifice, you know? It's glorious. It's glorious. Now, at that time, Milo and McCall are making for the sort of the dais, the throne. Not the throne. The dais. Yeah, the dais. That's the right word. They're going towards him there. McCall's pumping shots into him with his auto pistol. Milo's going for him as well. Sec is trying to summon a warp portal, but he lost so much power trying to kill the Saint earlier that he's not able to do it quickly enough. And when he does it, he pulls through McCall and Milo. And they land on a beach on an island a few miles away from this location. He's heavily wounded. He pulls out the stave Before we go on, what I like is that they see different things. Each of them sees a different thing. Like the chaos power around him makes them perceive Sek differently. So Holofernes, he sees him as a demon of Zench almost, fully like a demon. And, the other guy sees him as a skeletal lord, you know, like a walking skeleton. Milo sees him as a powerful warlord, like a muscle clad, like that dude from Batman. The one who talks like this with the gas mask on. I forgot what the fuck his name is. Jesus. Ah, God. I forgot. But yeah, everyone except McCall, who sees him for exactly what he is. No glamour works on McCall. He sees you. He's a hunter. He sees exactly what you are. And basically it ends with them fighting on the beach. Milo tries to ram a grenade down the maw of this guy. He's got like an endless swirling vortex for a mouth with little hands for teeth, little fingers for teeth. It's pretty gross. And he tries to ram a grenade down there. It doesn't work because the guy's like still super powerful. And McCall has a go, but he manages to do it. He rams a mine down there, but the mine's got not a magnetic thing, but basically like an attachment that allows it to be attached to walls and stuff. And it works on the mouth by the looks of it. And the Sek's head blows up, basically. And there you go. The Chaos Forces are in disarray. The voice, the continuous voice of their leader is gone. The thing that was unifying them. And they begin to flee the system and flee the planet. So the Imperial victory is assured. And with that, they have managed to take Erdesh, which is a crucial linchpin world for further expansion into this part of the universe, this part of the Sabbath cluster. It's essential for war material, and I believe it sits on like warp routes and stuff like that. So the Imperium has won a great victory, and it's sort of a new period of the Crusade is about to begin, with Gaunt pretty much as War Master, or the right hand of the War Master. That's where we're going forward now with the books. So now let's get into some of the bits I liked the best. Obviously, the time we spend with McCall is amazing. Behind enemy lines, doing all his stuff. He's just a fucking badass. Best character, best ghost. Brilliant. Brilliant. But not only that, because he spends a chunk of the book with this Sadia, this hostage, we learn a fair amount about Chaos Society. Now, I could go into depth of all the little bits and bobs, but I'm just going to run it down to this fairly chunky little quote, which I'm going to read to you. But I think it really reflects the different mentality of those who follow Chaos and despise the Imperium. And it's not as if they turn traitor. They've been brought up with a completely different perspective on the universe, which I think, again, Dan Abnett is one of the ones who does this stuff the best. And he's been building up on that for years now. He's really created that mentality, and we see it so clearly. So they're in this, this base, and there's a bunch of murals on the walls of this one building as they're sneaking through it. And McCall asks the Sadir why they're still up. You know, why haven't they been torn down? They're holy symbols of the Emperor. And the Sadir answers. So he says, why have they not been torn down? McCall asked Ollart. Ollart seems surprised. They show him as he is, he replied. Why would we break those? I don't understand. The Erdeshi know the deeper truths, said Ollart. They are kin to us. They understand the fluidity. You cannot stand upon a borderline for generations and not see both sides. Ollart glanced up at one of the images. See him there? Not as a false emperor surrounded by saints. He is shown as the machine, as the mutation, a force of war. He has always been a creature of the deep warp, warped like us. You know him only as you want to see him. Ollart made a gesture of respect to the engravings. You worship him? McCall asked. Nein, we respect, replied Ollart. He is no god, nor is he an emperor, but a prophet? Kar, yes. He has seen the enlightenment of the eight powers and witnessed the truth of the warp. Ghost, your kind, they follow blindly. They see what they want to see. The Holy Lord, blessed of all, defying the darkness. But he stands in the darkness, beyond the curtain of death, fed by the warp and changed by it. He is a brother to us, a brother we must sadly fight to subdue until he renounces his insurrection. Ollart looked at him. You know nothing of this, he asked. It makes no sense. This is because of your breeding, the indoctrination of your heretical culture. Do you not know why we fight? You fight to annihilate. Ollart shook his head sadly. You are a man of war, Ghost, he said. You have spent your whole life, I'd wager, serving your throne in the field of battle. And you have never stopped to wonder what those you fight believe in. What our cause is. McColl didn't reply. We fight to bring you back, said Ollart. We fight to break your mindset and your blind beliefs, to make you see the truth and embrace it. Your prophet lord has seen it, but he can no longer speak it. So your kind, they fight on according to ancient decrees and fossilized laws. Things you believe are what he would have wanted. He is of us, and will be welcomed back to our bosom on such day as his followers finally lay down their swords and accept the warped truth. Your faith in a man that was never a god has blinded you for 10 millennia. No, said McColl simply. This is the way of it, replied Ollart. You think we are the darkness, but you are the darkness. Your ignorance is a shadow in your eyes and a fog in your mind. We fight to deliver you from that. We fight, Ghost, to save you. And I think that says so much in a small amount of time. It's quality. It's quality. I do recommend this book for all of these reasons. It's absolutely great. And I can't wait to see what Dan Abnett does with this. I would like him to do more stuff in the 41st millennium, but obviously he's doing the Horus Heresy stuff at the moment. But yeah, the ability he has to show the chaos side of things, and that they are not all crazy, that they have... It's completely logical from their point of view, you know? You just have to... I don't know. There's a theological element, you know? I like it. It's good. It's good stuff. What else did we have here? So, yeah, we also get a nice moment where I thought was a nice touch. They only use pen and paper for records and stuff. They don't trust technology, which, again, I think it speaks to something, and I think it speaks to the origin of the Sanguinary Worlds, who they are. Are they descendants of people who sided with Horus during the Heresy and fled from Imperial space? Or are they from an older culture that was from the Dark Age of Technology, which sided with Chaos, embraced Chaos, and never knew the Imperial truth or anything like that, you know? I want to know this. I want to know how their society functions. I want to know more about the Sanguinary Worlds. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be great. So, some other stuff that I liked. I liked the Yonsi stuff. And Dali, obviously. The demon stuff. I liked it. It was entertaining. But I think it went on a bit too long. A good chunk of this book is that. And it became a bit of a grind for me. I think it was a bit much that Dalin was one as well. And I've been... I don't know how this... I mean, it's fine that he's done this, but I've just been reading Necropolis again because of the lore video that I'm doing. So I'm a bit sort of like, well, how did this happen? There's been no actual explanation, just that they were on the same planet as Herator Asphodel. I don't know if I'm missing something. I've missed a short story or something. I don't know. But, I mean, it's possible I must have done, because this doesn't quite... It rubs me a bit wrong that this has come to pass. And with all of the interactions they've had with the Inquisitors, with Psykers, with everything, and this was never detected. I mean, I guess that's the point. It was hidden. They were a hidden weapon. But, I mean, still, you know what I mean? They were a weapon of Sek, you know? Astrovol wasn't sided with Sek. It was before Sek. The timeline seems a bit off. I need an explanation. I mean, ideally, we could do with a new Sabbat Worlds background book to complement the original one, to push the campaign forward from there so we get all the detail. But I don't know. I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, it was a bit annoying. I would expect more firing squads to result from this whole occasion, because Crid seems to have just got off scot-free, even though she's been bringing up two demon children for the last like 20 years or so. And also, you know, all of the, well, 15 years maybe. You know, all of the ghosts have been affected by the influence of this spell, this warp magic that has hidden these demons, these demonic war engines from Scythe. And no one's got executed. I mean, what is this Inquisitor doing? I don't understand. All the stuff with McColl and Milo is brilliant. It's best bits of the book, clearly. The combat with the Mechanicum stuff, that's great. It's got a rawness to it. It's brutal. And also, most of the characters I dislike are now dead. So, brilliant. I'm looking forward to the series going forward. You know, Dower's wife, who was annoying, she's gone. That's great. And the kids are gone. Dallin is gone. Fake Milo, as I like to call him. He's gone. And, yeah, you know, Yonsei, this annoying, weird child, has gone. This arc has been closed off. I'm happy. It's great. There's been much purging and much fun for all. And hopefully no more boring family drama shit going forward. And we can get back to the action. You know, it's purified the timeline. Purified the amount of stuff you can put in the next books. We've got rid of a bunch of characters. We've got rid of a bunch of side plots and subplots, you know. Meryn's gone, all that shit. We can concentrate on having awesome stories again. Also, it's kind of heavily hinted that Hark's got a hard-on for the Inquisitor, who has never taken off her mask and looks like she's half-cyborg. I don't know why he's into that. Maybe it's the fact that he's got a metal arm. I don't know, but he seems to dig it. He's never seen her face. He seems to be the kind of guy who likes to see a woman. He's never seen her face. But we'll see what happens with that as well. Because that will be awkward. I'd like to see that. Why not? Why not? Put it in there, Dan Abnett. Let's have some cyborg sex. Why not? Okay, so some stuff I didn't quite like. There wasn't enough McCall in this book. Not enough. Nowhere near enough. Needs to be 50% McCall. Need a 50% increase in McCallness. The Yonsei stuff, as I say, it was a bit dragged on. And it had a lot of... What also took me out of it was you had all these other things going on with Meryn and Blenner and Merity Chase and all that shit. It all just, it felt like a bit much crowded into one thing. That meant it extended how big that sort of, that part of the story should have been and distracted from it as well, from the horror of the situation. I would also like to commend Dan Abnett for not going full on right on, you know. He has a lot of female characters in this story. The last book, it was starting to get a bit obnoxious, but this one he's toned it down a fair amount, and it's reasonable. That's the thing. I don't think anyone's got any problem with female characters. We just don't want Mary Sue's, and we want, like, I don't know. I have got no problem with a woman shooting another man, you know, using a machine gun, and or any gun, a laser rifle, whatever, killing someone. But when you see a woman beating a brutal veteran berserker warrior soldier from Chaos with her bare fists, it gets a bit, come on, man. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, she can shoot him. That's great. But she's not going to be able to go toe-to-toe with him. I mean, come on, man. There's a bit of this sort of thing in there that rubs you wrong. If you've ever, like, I don't know, had any interaction in society, you know. But it's fine. It's not obnoxious like some authors have been known to do. It's generally toned down. A lot of female characters now. I'd say, like, a lot of the main characters in the story now, I mean, it's probably like nearly 50-50, which I've got no problem with. But yeah, I just, if I see another story where like a woman is just beating up a man with her bare fists, I'll be annoyed. Because like, particularly in war, that ain't going to happen that much. You know what I mean? It's just unbelievable. But anyway, it's fine. It's fine. He does a good job there. It's not obnoxious. If this is what progressivism is in the books, I can live with it. As long as it doesn't sort of go beyond this and make it too ridiculous. But we are where we are, you know. Dan Abnett's not that bad with it. He's reasonable and he's realistic as well, which I have to say is commendable. So I mean, where are we? The crusade is coming to a conclusion, and a bunch of the subs plots and the boring stuff clogging up this arc of the story has now gone. It's been removed, so we should have a more fun and entertaining next book as we push forward with the crusade. Milo is back and is apparently a badass, which means that the saint, the avatar of the Emperor's will herself, will be in it more. And Gaunt is also now leading the crusade. So hopefully we'll get more sort of strategy stuff, generalship stuff, and more sort of politicking behind the scenes. So hopefully it brings in a bunch of different institutions and stuff like that. More Inquisitor stuff. I think they need a better Inquisitor. She seems far too lenient. Unacceptable. There's nowhere near enough firing squads and stakes in this story for an Inquisitor to be present. You know, even Eisenhorn, as enlightened as he was, he'd be burning motherfuckers all day long with this sort of shit going on. Anyway, I rate this book a solid 4. And as an example, I would say that Vervenhive, Necropolis, the third book, is probably a 5 out of 5 for me, just for enjoyability and everything in it. But yeah, I'll look forward to the next one. And hopefully with a more simplified cast, more simplified story arc going forward, we should have a more pleasing experience and a lot more concentrated and, you know, fun. You should be able to bring in fun stuff without having distracting subplots pulling us away from the main story, hopefully. And also, please, please, more chaos philosophy and thinking and their theology. I want more of that. At the end, Gaunt does a big victory speech, which I'll read a small part of now. Well, I'll read all of it. Astra Militarum, said Gaunt, speaking into the vox mic. His words boomed across the field. Guardsmen, Lasmen, I have been asked to address you today to deliver thanks for the struggles we have all endured together on Erdesh Forge World, and to celebrate our accomplishment here. Death is a part of our struggles, and that makes it hard to celebrate, even in a time of triumph. I wrote a speech. It was shit. So let's draw a veil over that. A murmur rippled across the field. It was just words, Gaunt went on. They rang false to me, so I know for sure they'll ring false to you too. I've heard enough generals speak in my time. It usually means nothing except that they like the sound of their own voices. You all know what you've done. He paused. He reached into his pocket and took out the signal paper Boltian had handed to him. He began to unfold it. A few minutes ago, I was passed a signal. Oops. Information has just been received. I want to share the contents of that signal with you because it will mean more to you than any glowing words I can muster. Just before noon today, the Astra Militarum Intelligence Service confirmed a report received yesterday from an Aeronautica Imperialis patrol on the Southern Oceanic Zone. The report, which has been verified, declares that 7 days ago, on an island called Orchidal, in the Farapan Archipelago, the archenemy Anarch, known as Sek, was apprehended and terminated by Astra Militarum troops. He looked up, the wind blew across the field. The banners whipped and cracked. I repeat, he said, the identity is verified and the termination is confirmed. The Anarch is dead. Today we have achieved a victory that has not been paralleled since Balhut. Perhaps the victory of this crusade. I feel that's the only thing you need to hear from me today. He stepped down from the lectern. Despite the wind, he could hear that the applause and cheering had already begun to spread through the lines. And then Trooper Purdy, the bunctious young lass. She plays Bryn Milo's pipes that were given back to Gaunt by the Saints. And Bryn Milo's still alive, of course, though. But he kept them with him the whole time. And she plays the Tanith music. And to this giant parade of Imperial glory, they've won. But not yet. There's still more to come. And I hope that book comes soon. We're probably looking... end of the year, probably start of next year, you know, January, so on, 2020. But I look forward to it. Hopefully we'll get it that soon, and it isn't another 10 years till we have to, another decade we have to wait. But yeah, thank you, Dan Abner. Glorious return to Gaunt's Ghosts, and I hope it continues. And yeah, more soon. Okay, well, that's all I've got for you guys today. I'm sure I could ramble on about other stuff, and there'll be stuff I'll remember afterwards. But if you've got any comments, please let me know below. If you enjoyed this review, please remember to like and share if you can, and subscribe to the channel if you've never subscribed before. Also, I would like to give a big thanks to everybody who's supporting the channel. You guys who are supporting the YouTube members. I'm going to try and do more stuff for you. Sorry that I haven't done anything just yet. I don't know what to do, to be completely honest. Yeah, if you want to join the Discord. A lot of you lads hang out in there now and again and post some stuff. Good little place to hang out for 40k chat, I think. And those guys on Patreon, you guys have been supporting me for the longest of anyone, and I really want to say I appreciate it so much. And you're going to get your money's worth soon. We're going to start making more content, and as we go forward, it's going to be good quality content. As well, I discussed this book review is in the old style, where I sort of make some notes and do a bit more of a slow and more in-depth look at a novel. And that's what I'm going to do going forward. But for short stories and sort of small audios, I'll probably do what I was doing before, you know, just put the camera on and give you my opinions, you know, live, you know, unedited. But we'll see how that goes. Depends on the story, I guess, what I've got to say, you know. So, yeah, I want to say a big thank you to Corey Desir. Apologies again if I'm mispronouncing your name, mate, who sent me the cash to buy this book, actually, which is fantastic. Thank you so much, mate. I really appreciate it. But if any of you guys, filthy shill, incoming right now, if you want to support me, please follow the links below. But no obligation. And, yeah, thanks for watching, and I will see you next time. Cheers.